In today's modern Western, we enter the desolate world of Highline, Montana, where we follow a rodeo queen's troubling but thrilling descent into the dark world of narcotics. So stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Upper East Table right here on the Popcorn Talk Network. As I mentioned at the top, we're reading a pretty exciting, thrilling, and dark pilot, hour-long drama pilot called The High Line, written by Stephen Camilleo. Stephen is actually based in Montana, so he will be calling in after we finish our read today, so we're excited to get him on the line. But before we do that, guys, this is a show, in case you're tuning in for the first time, where we table read Hollywood's hottest unproduced pilots and features. And my name is Jeff, and if you want to connect with me online, you can do that at Jeffrey C. Graham.
I am Haley O'Connor, and today I'm reading Shelby and Hollins.
What's up, everybody? I am Timothy Michael, and today I am reading Plummer, Langhorne, Manuel, Billy, and Pico.
Hey, guys, I'm Adrienne Snow, and I'm reading Scott, Nat, Tino, Lyle, Moretti, and Barboza. There
we go. Barboza. Hey, guys, I'm Andrew Guy. Today I'll be reading for, like, seven characters, but I'm digging Murphy the most. I think he's my favorite.
Hey, guys, Roxy Stryer here, and I will be reading for Black Elk, Lewis, Clyde, and Vinny.
Cool. So as I mentioned, guys, normally we have our writer kind of prep us into the world we're entering, but he is watching live. So, Steven, we're so excited to have you on soon.
Go, Steven.
Go, Steven.
Go, Steven. But before we do that, I mentioned it at the top, but this is about a pretty bleak kind of unpopulated part of Montana known as Highline, Montana, and I think Steven will have more insightful things to say about it, but there's kind of shades of Breaking Bad in this, but the thing I really liked about this pilot is it's female-driven, so Haley's playing our complicated protagonist, Shelby. Excitingly, this pilot actually just qualified as a finalist for the ATX Television Pitch Festival,
nice.
Which is cool.
Awesome.
We've had some other pilots that have done the same thing on this show, and it's well-deserved, so let's go ahead and get into it right now, guys. One more time, this is The Pilot to The High Line, written by Stephen Camilleo. Act 1. Interior, Wyatt's trailer, Great Falls, Montana, morning. Shelby Willow, 29, lies face down in bed in a shithole trailer with nothing of worth or permanence save a huge TV and leather saddle. Clothes, food, and bottles lie everywhere. Clad only in panties, bruises and scars cover Shelby's fit body. She sits up, pulls on a wife beater, flips the strawberry blonde hair out of her face. Bloodshot eyes, sun-kissed face, a constellation of freckles. Black rings under her eyes, like a girl from a Tom Petty song. She's good, but has had a bad time of it. Jed, an Australian sheepdog, comes over and nuzzles Shelby. Shelby rubs his nose and Jed flits away. Shelby eyes a pair of cowboy boots at her feet. They're striking, custom-made, and full of color and intricate details like a fire-snorting Mustang. Shelby winces. Flashback. Exterior, Montana Expo Park, Great Falls, Montana, night. In quick cuts, a rodeo under the lights. Cowboys and cowgirls of all ages cheer. In a bucking chute, locomotive breath, a huge ornery bull kicks and grunts wearing the cowboy boots, and Shelby slides onto the bull's back and ties in her left hand.
All right, this is your leader, Shelby Willow, riding locomotive breath.
Shelby nods.
Here we go. 3, 2, and 1.
The chute opens and locomotive breath bucks and spins into the ring. Shelby rides the bull, her right hand aloft, and locomotive breath wildly swings right, spins back left.
Here comes the spin cycle, folks.
Shelby's body whips around and she flies off the bull and crashes into the metal fence around the ring, crumples to the ground and closes her eyes.
Oh no, cowgirl down, cowgirl down.
Locomotive breath stops and stares daggers at Shelby. A rodeo clown jumps into the ring to distract the bull. No dice. The bull charges Shelby. Shelby's eyes flicker open and locomotive breath bears down. Shelby struggles to sit. Here comes the bull. She jumps up and climbs the fence and dives over the top just as the bull slams into where she was lying. Shelby crashes to the ground and looks into the face of Wyatt, 30s, a cowboy with a cheesy grin and slick goatee. End flashback. Shelby reaches for a bruise on her back and grimaces. On the other side of the bed, Wyatt rolls over and burps. Shelby blanches and forces bile down her throat. A bottle of whiskey sits on a beer cooler that doubles as a bedside table. She turns away in disgust. Her face turns green. Flashback. Interior, Sip and Dip Lounge, Great Falls, Montana, night. A nautical-themed dive bar. Tacky, but cool. Bikini-topped mermaids in their 20s swim in a tank behind the bar, and Shelby and Wyatt do shots with some rowdy rodeo cowboys at the bar. A drunk cowboy, 20s, plunges in the tank. The mermaids swim away. Shelby, Wyatt, and the rodeo cowboys cheer. Exterior Sip and Dip Lounge, Great Falls, Montana, continuous. Muscle-bound bouncers throw Shelby, Wyatt, and the rodeo cowboys out of the bar. Soaking wet, the drunk cowboy lies on the pavement puking. Interior Wyatt's trailer, Great Falls, Montana, later at night. Shelby and Wyatt crash through the door, stumble inside. Jed yelps and runs outside barking. Shelby drops her bag, fishes out an orange pill bottle, and pops a pill. Wyatt hands her the bottle of whiskey, and she washes it down. She puts the whiskey next to the bed, and Wyatt holds out his hand for a pill, and Shelby shakes her head no. Wyatt shoves her, and she shoves back. He grabs her, and they crash on the bed. They grapple, pulling hair. On top, Wyatt kisses Shelby hard. Shelby pushes him away. They lock eyes. Shelby flips Wyatt over and straddles him. He tries to sit up, but she pushes him down. Shelby lifts off her shirt, balls it in her hand and with the pill bottle, and tosses them in her bag on the floor. Wyatt pulls her down, kisses her neck, tugs at her bra. Shelby looks away at the pill bottle atop her bag. End flashback. Interior Wyatt's apartment, Great Falls, Montana, morning. Shelby gets up, wobbles, steadies herself on the wall, limps to the gym bag, and chucks the clothes out of it. Not finding what she looks for, she shakes it out, empty. She eyes the pill bottle on Wyatt's bedside cooler, and she limps over, grabs the pill bottle, turns it over, and it's empty. Shelby squints, balls her fists, grabs the whiskey, and dumps it on Wyatt.
Ugh, Jesus.
Wyatt leaps up and grabs the whiskey and pushes Shelby away.
What the fuck?
Wyatt chucks the bottle at Shelby and she ducks. Jed flees and the bottle crashes against the wall. Shelby holds up the empty pill bottle.
What the fuck?
Shelby chucks the pill bottle at Wyatt, hits him below the eye, and he wipes blood away from his cheek. Exterior, Wyatt's trailer, Great Falls, Montana, continuous. Bag over her shoulder, boots in hand, Shelby stumbles and is pushed outside. Jed follows and she sits on the front steps. Still in her underwear, she grabs a peasant skirt from her bag, pulls it on, and slides into her boots. Jed nuzzles her, she rubs his head.
We're out of here.
Shelby goes down the steps. Jed watches from the steps. Shelby flicks her head at Jed to follow. The door opens.
Jed, get the fuck in here.
The dog whines, tucks his tail back inside, and the door slams. Interior, Drug Enforcement Agency headquarters, Billings, Montana, morning. Slam. A huge plastic bag of cell phones wrapped of cellophane. Take that again. Slam. A huge plastic bag of cellophane wrapped cash hits a desk next to bags of narcotics. The noise gets the attention of four DEA agents sitting at their desk. In the front of the room with the money stands DEA District Chief Jay Murphy, 50s, gray, grizzled, and gruff. Behind him on the wall hangs a map of Montana.
That's 50 grand. I got 10 more of these in the evidence locker.
Hank Plummer turns around, whispers to a female agent. Plummer's 30, but looks 40 thanks to a beer gut, stubble, and thinning hair. Crumbs from a donut spot his shirt.
You know what 50 grand times 10 is, Plummer?
Fucking caboodle, sir.
Pretty much. And I got double that value in product. It was found on a pack mule that wandered out of the Bob Marshall Wilderness into the Browning.
Murphy turns to the map and indicates where he talks about.
Drug mules, using actual drug mules? Classic.
Less snickering, more head shaking from the other agents.
There's got to be some big shit going on if someone's making tracks across the border with that much cash, Mary and Joseph style.
Lorne Scott, 30s, the African-American agent seated across from Plummer, raises his hand and Plummer laughs.
Check out the teacher's pet.
No one else laughs, but everyone gives Scott the once over. Perfect hair, square chin, broad shoulders, clean shave, crisp uniform. He doesn't fit in. Murphy sees him and slaps his hand to his forehead.
Yeah, shit, almost forgot. Lauren Scott, this is everyone. Everyone, this is Lauren Scott. Transfer from Florida.
A few agents raise an eyebrow at the newbie. Scott nods.
What is it, Scott?
Whose product was it?
Who you think? Juarez has been running Montana for years.
Plummer snorts at his own joke, and other agents nod.
Oh, I'm glad you asked.
Murphy grabs a baggie of drugs and flicks it with his finger.
This looks nothing like Juarez's dope. The feds did a quick test, and the stuff seems to have a totally different makeup.
Smiles and laughter disappear.
Seems like there's a new player in town.
Scott nods, and Murphy looks at the names on the opposite wall. Plummer's name is at the top.
Plummer, you're top of the wall. Take Scott with you. Show him the ropes.
Exterior, Montana Expo Park, Great Falls, Montana, morning. Shelby parks her beat-up old Mustang by a bunch of run-down tour buses in the parking lot outside the arena. Interior, tour bus, Great Falls, Montana, continuous. Tex, 50s. 10-gallon hat, salt-and-pepper mustache. Big old belt buckle and a bigger ego. He counts out 320s on a table.
260, 280, three bills.
Where's the rest of it?
Healthcare ain't cheap, darling.
You sure as hell are.
You want it or not?
Tex reaches for the cash. Shelby grabs it and Tex smirks.
I need more oxy.
What happened to that stuff I gave you last night?
Why it happened to it?
He you lie down with dogs.
I don't need a lecture. I need pills.
Tex pulls out an orange pill bottle. Shelby reaches for it, but Tex pulls the bottle away and nods at Shelby's hand.
40.
Shelby eyes the cash in her hand and works her jaw.
You know what? I'm done with this shit.
Heard that before.
I mean it this time. Where's Lucy?
Ted flicks his head to the left. Shelby turns, stops, peels off two 20s, drops them, and puts her hand over her shoulder. Tex drops the bottle in her hand, and Shelby kicks the door open, and it swings in her wake. Interior, Montana Expo Park, Great Falls, Montana, continuous. Shelby walks past paddocks, horses eye her, and she steals a carrot from a feed bag. In the last paddock, Lucy, a gray roan, sticks her head out, nuzzles Shelby, and Shelby feeds Lucy a carrot.
Hey, Luce, let's get out of here.
Exterior, Highway 432, outside Great Falls, Montana, morning. A two-lane country road, big skies, rolling plains, wheat fields, and mountains in the distance. Shelby drives half in her lane and half on the shoulder. She rolls along at about 15 miles an hour and holds a rope that runs out the window to Lucy, who trots along beside the car. Exterior, Highway 2, Joplin, Montana. Shelby stands in front of an old ranch house. It sags under the weight of years of snow, wind, and neglect. Carcasses of old cars, mostly Mustangs, litter the yard. Behind the house, a battered barn makes for good photo ops for tourists, but it's otherwise useless. Lucy grazes on the long grass in the front yard, and a truck stops behind Shelby. She doesn't turn around.
Looking for her dad?
Guess so.
Can't remember the last time I saw him.
Me neither.
Shelby turns. Dick Langhorne, 60s, hangs out the window of an old Ford pickup. Dirty overalls, fatherly, with the permanent squint of a rancher. Langhorne is a man of few words that has seen everything in these parts.
Never one was for staying put.
Guess that's why he named me after a car.
Langhorne purses his lips, nods slowly, looks at his ranch and house across the street. They're well kept, though still weathered as everything is on the High Line.
My people homesteaded this land in 1891. Haven't strayed too far since. Now I'm the last one here.
Dick Jr.'s not around?
Seattle. Can't blame him. Not much in the way of opportunity left for folks your age around here.
Shelby surveys Langhorne's spread. Rows of short green crops line the land all the way to the horizon.
Peas look good.
Factory ranches. Fighting with the tribes over water. Government telling you what to do with your land.
Langhorne spits on the dry dirt.
Folks around here were better off during the Wild West. Couldn't make your own rules, make your own living.
It's Shelby's turn to purse her lips, nod.
Still rodeoing?
I don't think so.
Langhorne looks at the horizon, watches Lucy eat.
Need some feed for that hay burner?
Exterior, Highway 2, Havre, Montana, day. Hay sticking out of the trunk, Shelby drives past a sign that reads, Havre, Montana, welcome to the pride of the High Line. Cruising down the main street, Shelby could be going back in time to 1955. Sleepy is an understatement. Exterior Shelby's house, Havre, Montana, continuous. A prefab house from the 1920s. Once nice, it's past its prime. In the driveway sits a Ford truck and an old horse trailer. Shelby pulls in beside them, lets go of Lucy's rope. The horse eats the unmown grass in the yard. Shelby exhales, the tension releasing from her shoulders. A door slams. In her rearview mirror, Shelby sees the stooped Rita Black Elk, Native American, 70s, hobble from the house across the street, same as Shelby's, but clean and tidy. She's huffing and puffing, waves pieces of paper. Shelby rolls her eyes, and the tension returns. She slides out of the car, rubs her back, and puts on a fake smile.
Hi, Mrs. Black Elk.
It says right here in your lease.
Mrs. Black Elk flips through the papers and reads,
Rent shall be paid on the first of the month. Today is
She checks a pocket calendar like you'd get at the bank.
6th.
Shelby takes out her stack of bills, peels off a good chunk, and hands them to Mrs. Black Elk.
Sorry, I've been out of town. Here's half of it. I'll get you the rest as soon as possible.
Mrs. Black Elk pockets the cash and purses her lips.
Well, okay.
Mrs. Black Elk rifles through her papers, and Shelby cracks her neck as she reads.
Upkeep of the grounds is the tenant's responsibility. This includes...
Shelby kisses Mrs. Black Elk's cheek.
I'll mow the lawn.
Shelby grabs her bags out of the car and winces in pain.
Good to see you.
You look like shit.
Shelby raises a hand and limps to the door. Lucy saunters by Mrs. Black Elk, eats hay from the trunk, and Mrs. Black Elk flips through her papers, reads to Lucy.
No pets shall be allowed, even temporarily, anywhere on the property.
Off Lucy, munching away. Interior Shelby's house, day continuous. Shelby enters, drops her bag, and relaxes her shoulders. Wham! Shelby flies across the room and slams into a coffee table. A giant of a man, 20s, steps from the shadows, towers over Shelby, who scurries away across the floor and runs right into a pair of pointy Italian loafers. Shelby looks up, and the loafers belong to Manuel, 30s, a Latino with slicked back hair, and wearing a tailored suit. Manuel helps Shelby onto a thrift shop couch. The giant rifles through Shelby's bag, pulls out 220s, and drifts them on the coffee table.
That's all I got.
That's the problem. It's well short on the $1,500 you owe me.
Take my car, the truck and trailer.
Manuel brushes off his suit jacket and shakes his head.
Nope. I look like a used car dealer? A guy who sells shit on the Craigslist?
Well, I ain't got your money. Just kill me then.
I look like a killer. Man, I gotta take this one back.
The giant nods.
No. No, I don't kill you. I make you work it off. You'll spend the next 5 years in Juarez on your back with your feet in the air. You'll wish you were dead.
Shelby turns green and covers her mouth.
But I'd rather have my money.
Manuel saunters over to the window and watches Lucy feed.
So, on second thought, we'll take the trailer. That way you won't get any ideas about running and rejoining the circus.
Rodeo.
Whatever. You have 3 days. Adios.
Manuel and the giant exit. Shelby collapses on the floor. Exterior, ranch, Highline, Montana, morning. Shelby limps up a driveway to a large barn. A collection of male ranch hands hang around a bunch of pickup trucks filled with bales of hay. Nat, 40s, the lead cowboy, tall, mustache, Stetson, sees Shelby and spits tobacco.
Well, if it isn't the rodeo queen.
The rest of the cowboys eyeball Shelby.
Not anymore. Got any work?
I'm about to feed the shit factories. Saddle up.
Shelby nods. Exterior, ranch, Highline, Montana, continuous. The trucks fan out into an open pasture filled with cows. With another young cowboy, 20s, Shelby rides in the bed of one of the trucks stacked with hay bales. They use hay hooks to lift the bales and throw them over the side. Each time Shelby throws a bale, she winces. She's pale and sweats profusely. Shelby throws one bale off the truck and almost goes over the side with it. She crumples and reaches for her back. Exterior, the taco bus, day later. Shelby's Mustang screeches to a stop in front of an old school bus with tacos written across the side. Luis, 30s, a short Mexican guy, cleans out the bus, takes all the cookware, silverware, food, etc. to the back of an old green pickup and dumps it in the bed.
Hey, Luis, right? Where's Jesus?
Gone.
Gone where? Home?
Luis heads back to the bus for another load.
Gone, por siempre.
Por siempre? Forever? Gone forever?
Luis puts more pots and pans in the truck, hops behind the wheel, and Shelby limps to the truck and Luis starts it up.
Well, hey, where are you going?
Far away.
The truck peels out and leaves Shelby in a cloud of dust. Interior warehouse, Billings, Montana. In an open warehouse, 5 narcos, young Mexican men in their 20s, stand before a table of AKs. Behind them are Shelby's truck and trailer and a large U-Haul truck. Manuel and Tino Lopez, 50s, a heavy-set middle management type with a graying mustache and polyester shirt, stand next to a black Escalade with tinted windows. A man we can't see speaks in subtitled Spanish to Tino from the half-open back window.
Did you tell these boys to be ready? I don't trust these fuckers.
All due respect, then why are we meeting with them?
Juarez sets it up. Think doing a deal with bring on a truce, stop the violence is a stupid. They're blind. The shrimp that falls asleep is swept away by the current.
What?
They're sleeping on the enemy.
Yes, sir.
So you stay awake.
Tino nods. The narcos lock and load their guns. Interior, Jeff's skate shop, Big Sandy, Montana, day. Shelby lays $20 on the counter, and Jeff Vetter, 40s, going on 15, FUBU sweatshirt and baggy jeans, eyes the cash. He plays with the white guy dread sticking out of the 90s-style floppy Rasta hat, and skateboards line the walls. Cool clothes and shoes for sale, but no customers.
Sorry, no dice.
Come on, Jeff. It's all I got. Just a little taste.
You don't get it. I'm out. Everyone is. She's dried up.
Bullshit.
Jeff raises an eyebrow and opens a box of new sneakers, pulls one out, and inhales the new shoe smell.
I just saw Tino. Something's going down.
Jeff offers the shoe to Shelby, but she declines. He shrugs and takes another deep whiff.
Let me go see Tino.
Jeff laughs.
No way, bro. First, he'd kill me. Like, literally kill me, B. You'd never find it. I was just out there. It's a bitch to find. I actually had to use Google Maps.
Shelby pulls out her phone and Jeff's phone rings.
Yo, you calling me?
Shit, sorry. Hey, you still have those Vans I liked?
The black ones? Yeah.
Can I try them again?
Sure. You finally ready to wear something other than those boots?
Maybe.
Hold on.
Jeff puts his phone down and vanishes into the back. Shelby watches him go, grabs his phone. It's still unlocked. She opens Google Maps, takes a picture of the last address with her phone, puts the phone back. Jeff comes out of the back holding a box.
Classic checkerboard Vans.
But Shelby's gone. Jeff shrugs and takes a whiff of the shoes. Exterior, warehouse, Billings, Montana, night. Shelby checks her Google Maps. She's in the right place. She slides out of her Mustang outside a dimly lit warehouse in an industrial area. It's dead quiet. Shelby notices a door ajar. Checks it out. Knocks.
Hello, Tino?
Nothing. She steps inside and jumps back to see eight dead men, guns in their hands, lying on one side of the warehouse. The five narcos, Manuel and Tino, lie dead on the other side. Machine guns lie next to their bodies. In between the groups of dead men is the U-Haul truck and Shelby's truck and trailer. Shelby approaches the U-Haul, lifts the roll-up door, and Shelby stumbles backward, falls on her butt, and her mouth drops open. The truck is filled top to bottom with narcotics.
Ooh.
End Act 1. Act 2. Interior warehouse, Billings, Montana, night. Shelby stares wide-eyed at the drugs in the truck. She looks at her truck and trailer, and she takes a deep breath and opens the big bay doors of the warehouse, hops in her truck and trailer, and pulls it outside. She stops the truck and sits outside the warehouse. The truck idles. She looks at herself in the rearview mirror, drums her fingers on the steering wheel. After a beat, she slams the truck into reverse, backs into the warehouse right up to the U-Haul, and she closes the warehouse doors, opens the back doors of the trailer and the U-Haul. She hops into the U-Haul and chucks a brick of drugs into the trailer. Exterior, Highline, Montana, morning. Scott drives a black Ford Bronco west into the rising sun. Plummer rides shotgun, and the road stretches out in front of them. On either side, ranches go on forever.
There she is. Montanada. Nada. Get it?
See?
Cool. You speak Mexican. Montana's got 6 people per square mile. In this area, the Highline, it's under 3 in most places.
Well, just the way the cartels like it. Empty land and a lot of it.
They cut landing strips in the national forest and no one fucking knows. Come down from Canada in ATVs on horseback and fucking canoes.
Plummer shakes his head.
Canoes. Local fuckers.
Plummer nods to a turn.
This is us.
Scott turns and in the distance, a large forest looms and snow-capped peaks poke up on the horizon.
So, transferred, yeah?
Yeah, it's a long story.
It's a long drive.
Scott ignores him. Plummer shrugs and pushes a CD into the radio. A modern pop country song plays and Scott cringes.
You like country music?
No.
Scott hits scan and dead air comes on the radio. The radio circles through the stations, finding nothing but dead air.
What'd I tell you? Montanada.
Plummer puts the country song back on and they drive. Exterior, forest, south side of the Montana-Canada border, day. Scott and Plummer hike through the forest. Scott moves with determination and readiness. Plummer, 2 steps behind, breathes heavy and struggles to keep up.
So, Lauren, that's a chick's name, yeah?
It's not Lauren. It's Lorne, like Lorne Michaels.
Yeah, I never heard of her.
Lorne.
Plummer scrunches up his nose and can't hear the difference.
How about Lauren Green?
Plummer's brain works.
Ben Curry? Bonanza!
Scott nods.
Damn, my pa loved that shit. Yeah.
Plummer gets into it, looks skyward, hums louder and faster. Scott stops in his tracks and lowers his gaze and slowly scans the forest in front of him. Crack, crack! Plummer snaps back into reality and follows Scott's gaze. Something moves in the trees. Plummer hums quieter.
Da-da.
Crash! Scott and Plummer reach for their guns. Out of the trees bound 3 pack mules. Scott and Plummer exhale. The mules are skittish, and they still have drugs and money attached. Plummer grabs the reins on one and tries to pull it further into the woods. The mule bucks and lets out a scream. Scott and Plummer cover their ears.
Oh, something over there has spooked them.
Plummer releases the mule and follows Scott into the trees. They push through the branches and stop at a creek, and a pack of ravens stalk the ground near the creek. Scott takes a step forward. Caw, caw, caw! The ravens make a ruckus and fly off, exposing a giant pool of blood on the stones. The noise of ravens dies down, and sun filters through the trees, causing a natural light show. Scott squints. Exterior forest, south of the Montana-Canada border, day. Scott and Plummer stare at the pool of blood and scratch their heads. Interior, Jeff's skate shop, Big Sandy, Montana, day. A bag slung over her shoulders, Shelby enters the shop. Behind the counter, Jeff waves her away.
I got nothing for you. Nobody does.
Shelby drops the bag on the counter in front of Jeff.
What if I have something for you?
Jeff eyes the bag. Shelby nods to it, and Jeff opens it, pulls out a brick of drugs. He does a double take and shoves the drugs back in the bag and pulls it shut.
The fuck? Someone could see you.
Shelby looks around. Again, No customers.
Who? There's never anyone in here.
Jeff frowns and peeks in the bag again.
Yo, where'd you get this?
You don't want to know.
Jeff peeks at the drugs again.
Jeez.
Know anyone who would pay for that?
What?
50-50 split.
A smile creeps onto Jeff's face.
I could use the cash.
Me too.
I know some guys.
Sounds perfect.
What if Tino finds out?
I don't think that'll be a problem.
Jeff shoots Shelby a sidelong glance, and she smiles. Exterior, campground, Highline, Montana, night. In the woods of a gravel ground, Jeff, with Shelby riding shotgun, pulls his VW van into a campground. Across the parking lot, a tricked-out Dodge Ram pickup sits alone. Jeff parks, and two good old boys exit the pickup.
Let me do the talking. These guys don't mess around.
Fine, just get the money.
Jeff and Shelby exit the van, and Jeff raises his chin to the two men. The driver of the truck is Billy. 30s, wiry, a week's worth of stubble on his face and sleeve tattoos on both arms. Clyde, 20s, a husky farm boy, sports a dirty trucker cap and overalls. Both men I fuck Shelby, and she looks away in disgust.
Hey, Billy. Clyde.
Hey, Tony Hawk. You get some of those Back to the Future hoverboards yet?
Actually, I can get them if you want.
Billy waves Jeff off and rolls his eyes at Clyde, who smirks at Jeff.
Dude, I don't fucking care. Who's the broad?
This is my
associate. I don't fucking care either. See the goods.
Jeff looks around, opens the bag, and shows Billy the drugs. Billy reaches out for the bag, and Jeff pulls it back.
Easy, dude. Just want a taste. I'm used to dealing with Tino.
Oh, I got this from Tino.
Is that so?
Yeah, it's the real deal. Trust me.
Trust is a two-way street, bro.
Jeff reaches in the bag and pulls out a baggie, flips it over to Billy, and Billy turns it over in his hand, hands it to Clyde, who pulls out a knife, stabs the bag, and licks some white powder off the knife. Clyde's eyes go wide, and his neck snaps back. He licks his lips and nods to Billy.
Told you, bro. Let's see the money.
Did I skip a page?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Sorry, guys. Clyde opens the door of the truck, pulls out a shotgun, and points it at Jeff.
The bag.
Oh, what the hell, bro?
Shelby steps forward, and Clyde swings the shotgun to her.
You want to mess with Tino like this?
You're full of shit.
Oh, yeah? You want to try me, motherfucker?
Billy steps up to Jeff, pulls out a gun from behind his back, and pistol whips Jeff on the side of the neck. Jeff slumps to the ground and curls up into fetal position.
Tino's dead, motherfucker.
We're running shit now.
Clyde steps up and kicks Jeff in the ribs. Shelby tries to kick Clyde in the balls, but Billy catches her foot, holds it so she has to hop around. Billy eyes her cowboy boots.
Nice shit, cookers.
Billy flips Shelby's foot backwards so she lands on her ass next to Jeff. She sits up, touches Jeff's shoulder.
You okay?
Jeff moans. Billy and Clyde peel out, spraying gravel all over Shelby and Jeff. Exterior, Shelby's house, night. Shelby pulls up to her house, driving Jeff's van. Jeff slumps over in the passenger seat. She gets out and helps Jeff to the front door.
Oh, fuck me.
Shelby rips an eviction notice off of her front door. She turns and glares at Mrs. Black Elk's house across the street, where a curtain closes and the lights go off. Interior, Shelby's house, continuous. Shelby helps Jeff flop on the couch, puts some ice on his head, and drops a beer and his keys in front of him.
What are we gonna do?
Yo, you got a mouse in your pocket? Because I know you ain't talking to me.
Come on. God only knows the value of the junk's in that horse trailer.
Yeah, it can rot there for all I care. I'm done. Find another partner.
Jeff reaches for his beer and grunts in pain. He winces as he picks up the TV remote and flicks it on. Shelby plops on the couch next to Jeff, buries her head in her hands, and Goodfellas comes on TV.
Ah, nice. Here we go.
Jeff lies down on couch. Shelby raises her head, stares at the TV. A grin creeps across her face. What she pops up.
What the hell? Where are you going?
Missoula.
Shelby grabs Jeff's keys, heads for the door.
I don't have any gas, so I'm taking the van.
Shelby slams the door behind her.
The fuck is in Missoula?
Jeff shrugs and goes back to his beer and the movie. End of Act 2. Act 3. Interior classroom. University of Montana. Missoula, Montana. The resplendent red brick main hall of the U of M campus, which is neatly tucked into the surrounding mountains. In a modern auditorium-style classroom, Chuck Lyle, 29, lectures before a class of 40 freshmen. Bearded with long hair, Lyle wears jeans and a tattered corduroy sports coat over a Metallica t-shirt.
So that's the story of the Virginia City, Montana vigilantes. The question remains, were these good men doing bad things for the greater good? Or bad men using good excuses to commit crimes? It's 160 years later, and the jury is still out.
Lyle turns and writes 3777 on the board behind him.
But this sense of independence and distrust is still embedded in Montana culture. Like, look no further than the vigilante code. No matter its meaning, the dimensions of a grave, a date, or warning to get a $3 ticket on the 7 a.m. coach for the 77-mile trip from Helena to Butte, These numbers still grace the badge of the Montana Highway Patrol.
Lyle eyes Shelby standing in the back of the auditorium. He does a double take, smirks, and closes his notes.
Why? Think about this weekend. Now scram.
The students gather their things and leave. Shelby remains standing at the door. Interior, Lyle's apartment, Missoula, Montana. Lyle and Shelby enter Lyle's off-campus apartment. The walls are plastered with movie posters by films by Tarantino, Scorsese, Coppola, etc. The place is decorated hoarder style with every inch of it covered in books, DVDs, tapes, recorders, newspapers, magazines, CDs. Lyle clears off some space on the couch and flops down. He grabs a clear bong, sparks it up, and takes a long hit, offering it to Shelby. Shelby stares at the smoke floating in the cylinder. She's mesmerized for a beat before shaking her head. Nope. Lyle gets out a cloud of smoke and waves it away.
You've got a truckload of drugs, and you think I can help you get rid of it. Unless you think I can smoke it all, why me?
Because you're the smartest person I know.
9 majors, hundreds of credits, and 10 years at college with a useless degree in history does not make me make one smart. Quite the opposite, in fact.
Come on, I saw you up there. Remember all those movies you could quote word for word that I never even saw? Nobody knows more useless stuff than you, especially when it comes to Montana.
Lyle takes another hit, stares at the ceiling, and exhales a big cloud of smoke.
You remember that scene in The Untouchables they shot on the Hardy Bridge up near Cascade? When Costner captures all the Capone's whiskey?
Shelby stares blankly at Lyle.
Yeah, of course not. Before the Mexicans started bringing stuff over the border, the mob did it during Prohibition.
The mob?
Yeah, like Capone and Lucky Luciano, Joey Bananas Bonanno had secret airstrips up along the border. And they all came through Montana. And coming from New York City and Chicago, they had never seen anything like it. All the mobsters from back east brought land out here. And some say the Lucianos still run their operation out of Libby.
Libby, Montana? Blink and you miss it, Libby?
Lyle nods and takes another hit, and it jogs something loose from his memory. He exhales.
You know what? I've never been out there, but supposedly outside of Jordan, there are a ton of mansions in the middle of nowhere. Like, not ranch-lock homes, but Spanish-style villas, brick manors, southern plantations. Rumor has it they're all owned by gangsters. The Colombos, the Genovese, the Benibinian, the Cosmo, the Planet D. Domenico, Vinny Butts Batuco. find yourself a man and make an offer he can't refuse.
Again, Shelby stares blankly at Lyle.
Really? Like nothing. The Godfather.
Shelby shrugs.
Get out of here.
Lyle takes another hit and disappears in a cloud of smoke. Exterior, Montana Highway, Jordan Day. Shelby cruises past a sign that reads, Jordan, Montana, population 340, into miles of open range land and bedlands. Cowboy country meets dinosaur fossil hotbeds. There isn't another person or house in view. Shelby drives along, still nothing to see but grass and hills. Shelby rolls over a crest in the road and stops. She gets out of the car and stares down the hill, and below there are a handful of gated mansions on each side of the road with large fenced properties that stretch out to the horizon. Shelby hops back in the car and rolls down the hill. She stops at the first gate. She gets out, goes to the gate and presses the intercom. Bzzz. She waits. Nothing. In quick cuts, Shelby at another gate. It has a video monitor attached with a blinking red light. Shelby waves to a video camera on the gate, and after a beat, the monitor flashes a message. Access denied. Another gate that has a sign on it reading, Warning, armed electric gate, 7,000 volts. She picks up a stick, throws it at the gate, and the gate sizzles. Shelby recoils. Now Shelby stands at a gate marked with a big ornate B on it, but no monitor and no keypad. Shelby cups her hands around her mouth and yells,
Hello?
A red Porsche blows past Shelby's and goes to the gate with the B on it. The gate opens automatically and the Porsche enters. Shelby watches the Porsche fly down the dirt driveway with the gate remaining open. She pauses, thinks, and jumps in the Mustang and steps on the gas, headed for the gate. The gate begins closing, but Shelby squeezes the steering wheel. The gate closes more. Shelby directs the Mustang through the gate with just enough room to spare. She hits the brakes and watches the gate close behind her, staring at the big B on the gate. Exterior, Boutico Estate, Jordan, Montana, moments later. Shelby approaches the front door of a huge faux Gothic mansion surrounded by an English garden. Beyond, hundreds of acres of open prairie encircle the house and garden. Shelby rings the bell, a beat, and an ancient butler in his 80s in a bow tie, black suit, and gray waistcoat opens the door. Yes?
I'm here for a meeting with Mr. B.
The butler frowns and Shelby grins. You have a meeting with Mr. Botico?
Yes, I do.
The butler looks Shelby up and down, and she smiles meekly. Very well. The butler moves aside and allows Shelby to enter. She steps in the door, stops in her tracks, and takes in the immense and elaborate atrium. Interior office, Botico Estate, Jordan, Montana, continuous. Shelby tiptoes into the darkly lit office. The door closes behind her. Hunter green paint, hunting paintings, and leather-bound books, decor so predictable it almost seems fake. Shelby makes her way to the only personal touches in the room, a group of framed photos. The photos all feature the same man, a handsome, olive-skinned gangster type with a striking head of hair and a pompadour. He's photographed with Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Don Rickles, Joe Namath, and Marilyn Monroe. The door opens and the butler pushes a wheelchair into the room. In it is Vinny Butts Botico, the man from the pictures. His skin is paper white, his eyes are watery, and he's rail thin, but the pompadour, now stark white, remains perfectly coiffed. Continued. The butler wheels Mr. Botico over to a window that looks out onto the English garden full of roses and statues of Greek gods. The butler nods to Shelby and exits. Shelby approaches Mr. Botico, who stares out the window. He's out of it. Shelby sits on the window ledge right in front of him, and he stares right through her. She waves her hand. Nothing.
Mr. Botico?
He doesn't flinch. Shelby buries her head in her hands, and she pulls her hands away, tears welling up in her eyes. She wipes them away and laughs at herself.
Jesus, what did I expect? I was going to waltz into some mobster's, no offense, house, and he was just going to be like, yeah, I'm a drug dealer. I'd love to help you unload $1 million worth of dope.
Shelby gets off the ledge, moves to leave, but stops and turns.
It's nice to meet you. I like your hair.
He doesn't move. Shelby exits the office and walks toward the front door. Her boots echo in the atrium, and the butler tries to catch her. She waves him off.
I'll see myself out, thanks.
Shelby jumps in her Mustang, hits the gas, and sprays gravel, speeding away. Exterior, Montana Highway continuous. Shelby stares straight ahead, face blank. She's all cried out. She clocks the red Porsche in her rearview mirror, but it's got New York plates and flies up right behind her and lays on its horn. Shelby bites her lip.
Oh, shit.
The driver waves a hand out of the room. Shelby floors it, and the Mustang pulls away. The Porsche's engine revs, and in seconds, the Porsche pulls along the Mustang.
Fuck you.
The driver yells at Shelby, but Shelby doesn't look. Just slaps a middle finger on her window. The Porsche speeds past Shelby and cuts off both lanes of traffic. Screech! Shelby slams on the brakes. She stops just short of T-boning the Porsche. The driver, female, 20s, gets out of the Porsche and marches to Shelby's window, sporting badass business attire. Black leather skirt, white silk top, herringbone leather, jacket, blazer, and heels. Shelby freezes in awe, then searches the car for a weapon. The driver knocks on Shelby's window and says something. She repeats her words and Shelby cocks her head, stops searching. Shelby looks the driver up and down and cracks the window.
What?
My name is Vinny Botico.
Wait, the Vinny Butts?
No, I'm Vincenzo. He's my grandfather. You just met with him.
So?
I think we should talk. You know, the Daily Cop about a mile ahead.
Shelby shrugs.
Meet me there.
Vinny fires up the Porsche and takes off. Shelby watches till she's gone and drops her head on the steering wheel. Exterior, Daily Cup a couple minutes later. An old farmhouse turned diner on the side of the road. Did I skip a page?
No.
Okay. It's the kind of place where farmers sit and bullshit about stock crop prices over a 5-cent cup of joe. Shelby pulls up and the red Porsche sits out front next to a bunch of old pickups. Interior Daily Cup continuous. Shelby enters the diner. Vinny, with a huge leather hobo bag hanging in the crook of her arm, laughs at something an old farmer, 70s, says to her. The old farmer pats Vinny on the back, and the hostess, 60s, blue hair and overweight, approaches Vinny and caresses Vinny's hand.
Your regular booth, Vinny.
You spoil me, Deb.
Shelby follows Vinny and Deb to a booth in the back corner. Vinny waves to the other farmers as she walks. Deb hands Shelby a menu and leaves. Vinny scoots into a booth, her back to the wall and facing the door.
Granddad always told me, tip $100 when you walk in a joint and always sit with your back to the wall and eyes on the door.
Debbie comes over with a coffee and slides a plate of eggs, toast, and potatoes in front of Vinny.
The usual.
Ah, thank you.
Deb looks at Shelby, who looks like she could use a good meal.
And how about you, hon?
Shelby shakes her head. No.
You sure? Nothing beats breakfast for lunch.
Shelby shakes her head, and Vinny shrugs at Deb, who frowns and walks away.
I think I should go.
Shelby gets up and turns to go.
So tell me about this $1 million worth of dope.
Shelby stops, sits back down, and stares at Vinny.
That mansion has more cameras in it than a Japanese tour bus. Come on,
Tell me.
Vinny takes a big bite of egg and chews vigorously.
I don't even know who you are.
Vinny swallows, wipes her mouth.
Well, I told you my name. What else do you want to know? Fire away.
What are you doing in Montana, for starters? Your license plate's in New York.
Let's just say my folks weren't too happy that after I got a business degree from NYU, I wanted to go into the family business. Said I should get an internship. Internship. Work for free. Fuck that.
Then he takes another bite, chews, swallows, and talks.
I got into a little scrape, and they told me they'd cut me off or ship me out here to look after my grandfather. No nurse, Steve Kazi.
What's that mean?
Fuck that.
Shelby rolls her eyes.
But then I thought about it. Back home, everyone's fighting for scraps, trying to get made. Plus, those old Goombas only think a woman is good for cooking, cleaning, and fucking shit. They want. Fuck that.
Shelby raises her head and meets Vinny's gaze.
You know what I mean? What about what we want out here? I could set up my own thing, be my own boss.
Vinny shrugs and takes another bite, chews, and talks.
But I'm open to a partnership. Hell, Hewlett and Packard, Gates and Allen, Jobs and Wozniak. So, where'd you score the product?
I'm gonna tell you. Fuck that.
Vinny smiles, lifts her fork, and points it at Shelby.
Nice. What's your plan? Going door to door till you sneak in another gate?
Shelby looks away, her hand jittering on the table.
So there is no plan. Always gotta have a good business plan. Unless you plan to use it all yourself.
Shelby glances at Vinny, who nods to her shaking hands.
I gotta go.
Shelby jumps up and storms out of the diner. Vinny watches her go and shrugs and takes another bite of eggs. Exterior, Montana Highway, later day. Not paying attention, Vinny cruises along listening to a business podcast. Shelby's Mustang flies up behind her, passes her, and cuts her off. Vinny slams onto the brake, barely avoiding Shelby's car. Shelby exits the Mustang, pale and sweaty, and staggers to Vinny's window.
So what's our plan?
A big grin stretches across Vinny's face. Stone-faced, Shelby stares at her for a beat before doubling over and puking all over the hood of the Porsche. Shelby crumples to the ground, and Vinny's smile fades. End of Act 3. Act 4. Interior bedroom, Batico Estate, Jordan, Montana, morning. Shelby prides open her bloodshot eyes. Pale and clammy, she swims in the covers of a huge four-poster bed. She turns her head to take in the rest of the room, and her eyes flash with pain. With great care, she sits up, puts her legs over the bed's edge, and her boots lay on a fine Parisian rug next to a bucket. Some clean clothes sit on the polished mahogany nightstand. Shelby slides out of bed. Her feet touch the floor and her knees buckle. Finds her balance, picks up the clothes from a nightstand, and she looks in the mirror holding a pair of pink booty shorts with Juicy on the back. She raises an eyebrow. Interior office, Batico Estate, Jordan, Montana, morning. Shelby enters his office wearing the pink shorts and the pink sweatshirt. Vinny talks on the phone, points to a table with a pitcher of coffee and fine china. Shelby pours herself a cup. She's drawn to pictures of Vinny's grandfather on the wall.
That's bullshit.
A beat.
Oh, first I'm inexperienced. Now I'm too emotional. Fuck that. I bet you didn't say that to my grandfather when he cut off your finger for skimming his cut. Yeah, I know about that.
A beat. Vinny looks at her phone. Call ended.
Shit.
Oh, I just skipped a line. Sorry, guys. Vinny shifts her gaze to Shelby.
Feeling better?
Nope.
Good.
Shelby turns to Vinny, and Vinny meets her gaze.
Now you know why we sell this shit, not ingest it.
Shelby rolls her eyes, turns back to the pictures.
Yeah, so how's the selling going?
Shitty. All my granddad's old cronies are either dead, retired, or stupid.
Vinny approaches Shelby, eyes a photo of her grandfather with a sour man with a square head and flat, crooked nose.
That's J. Edgar Hoover.
Really?
Yeah. Granddad said, knowing your enemies is more important than trusting your friends.
Vinny's eyes wander to another photo of her granddad with the Tommy Tomato Moretti 40s, a red-faced mobster in a double-breasted suit.
Fucking A. That's it.
Recharged, Vinny marches off. Shelby watches her go.
Come on, Juicy.
Off Shelby, staring at a photo of Moretti. Exterior garden, Moretti Estate, Jordan, Montana, continuous. Moretti, still red-faced, but now in his 70s, waters his huge tomato garden. Vinny stands next to Moretti, and behind them, Shelby, barely able to stand, wilts in the midday sun. Moretti looks at Shelby and frowns at her.
So let me get this straight. You want me to come out of retirement to help you and your junkie friend make a play?
Yep.
Yeah. You know, I never liked your grandfather. Everyone else did, but I saw through the hair and bullshit to his red-ass core.
Vinny smiles and steps forward, picks a tomato, bites it, and spits a chunk of it on the ground.
Hey.
Granddad always said you were bitter.
Vinny flips Moretti the tomato, and he catches it.
We're out of here.
Moretti watches the girls go, looks at the bitten tomato, drops it on the ground, and crushes it with his foot. Exterior Moretti Estate, Jordan, Montana, night. A moonlit night. Vinny and Shelby stand next to the porch looking at Moretti's lush vegetable garden.
If Moretti doesn't want anything to do with us, why are we here?
An engine roars, and Vinny nods to the road. Over a hill comes a tractor driven by the old farmer Vinny talked to at the cafe. The farmer raises a finger off the steering wheel to Vinny. The tractor slams right into the gate and throws it forward and enters Moretti's property. The tractor crashes into the garden, destroying the ripe tomato plants.
Damn, isn't this going to piss off Moretti?
Vinny moves to the Porsche and opens the driver's drawer.
That's the plan. When I first came out here, I just sat in my grandfather's study and read to him everything you can think of about Montana and the West.
Vinny and Shelby get in the car.
Before World War II, the Nazis broadcast radio messages to Native Americans to get them to join Germany's fight against the U.S. government. They figured the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Vinny fires up the Porsche.
The Indians were like, fuck that. We're going to scalp the mustache smeller. That's what they called Hitler, mustache smeller. Didn't work, but the thinking behind it was sound, so.
So
Moretti's sworn enemy is Mr. D. Dementio. So now, by definition, we're Mr. D.'s friend.
Interior warehouse, Billings, Montana, day. Scott and Plummer stare, and dead bodies litter the floor.
Tino Lopez, local boss for the Juarez. I can't say anything today. Cartel.
You've done your homework. This is Manuel, one of his lieutenants.
Plummer casts his hand at the dead man behind Tino.
These are his amigos.
Plummer walks over to the other side of the warehouse.
But who the hell are these fucking stormtrooper wannabes?
Plummer scratches his head and ass at the same time.
No survivors.
Scott surveys the scene, looks at the cat walk up above and the empty oil drums around the warehouse floor.
And there are so many great places to set up in here if you're going to ambush someone.
Had to have been a deal gone bad. They're facing off directly at one another.
Yeah, but
Scott looks down at the dead stormtroopers in their commando gear and helmets.
Would you do a deal with these guys?
Scott's eyes search the warehouse and he scratches his chin.
What?
If this was a deal gone bad, where's the product?
So, we got a survivor?
That or someone beat us here.
Interior, Lolo Creek Steakhouse, Lolo, Montana, day. A few tourists eat at tables in this restaurant with the log cabin interior and antler chandeliers and all manner of hunting trophies hanging on the walls. In the back, Nikki Barboza, 60s, huge head and nose, sporting a lime green knit polo circa 1960, mauls a huge bloody steak while he talks. His iPhone with a pack of smokes on top of it lies by his plate. From Nikki's POV, an untouched steak sits in front of the person Nikki talks to. We don't see their face. All we see is cleavage and a black bra under a white V-neck.
Mr. DiDomenico had me take this meeting as a courtesy. He appreciated how you handled the Moretti situation and out of respect for your family name and everything your grandfather did.
Barboza makes the sign of the cross.
God rest his soul.
He had a stroke. He's not dead.
Oh. Barboza shrugs and checks out the cleavage again, stuffs a huge forkful of meat in his mouth, and eyes some more tits.
Eating through a tube ain't living.
Barboza looks down and goes to town on his steak.
Well, I took this meeting as a courtesy as well. I wanted to pay my respect to Mr. D, but I have enough product to run my own show.
Barboza stops eating and raises his eyes to Vinny's face.
Really? You have that much?
Vinny pushes back her seat and stands.
Whoa, okay. Wait a second, dear. You haven't even touched your steak.
I don't eat red meat.
Oh, Santa Cielo, are you kidding me?
No.
Barboza chuckles.
You ain't gonna survive long out here.
We'll see.
I guess we will. So, how much you got?
A truckload?
Barboza picks up the phone. The screen shows it's been on a call this whole time they've been talking.
You hear that, boss? Yes, sir.
Barboza hangs up, motions to a waitress in her 30s. When she comes over, Barboza takes a pen and pad out of her apron and nods for her to leave. Barboza writes a phone number on the pad, rips off the paper, and holds it out to Vinny, but just far enough so she has to reach across the table to give him a look down her shirt.
Tasty.
Off Barboza, steak blood dripping down his chin. Exterior, side of the road, Libby, Montana, night. The siren lights of a local sheriff's cruiser light up the emptiness of the Montana night. On the shoulder, the cruiser sits behind the old green pickup from the taco bus. A sheriff in his 50s stands behind the pickup. A Bronco pulls up behind the cruiser, and Scott and Plummer get out. The sheriff nods to them as they approach the pickup. The front door is wide open, and inside, blood is everywhere. Luis's body slopes in the driver's seat, one bullet hole in his head and one in his chest. Exterior, dirt road, Whitelosh, Montana, night. Shelby fidgets behind the wheel of her truck and trailer, and Vinny sits shotgun tapping on the dash. The black Escalade with tinted windows from the warehouse pulls up, and three narcos, drug traffickers, wearing Mexican soccer jerseys, gets out. Leon, 30s, big-boned, and Atlas, 23, wiry and baby-faced, carry Uzis. Chivas, 30, tall and imposing, stands before the SUV. Shelby and Vinny look at each other and get out, stand in the front of their vehicle, and Chivas nods to Atlas and Leon, who circle behind Shelby and Vinny, disappear behind the trailer. The trailer opening breaks the silence.
Hey, what the fuck?
Shelby marches to the back of the trailer and stops in her tracks, stumbling backwards with her hands up, when Leon appears with his big gun pointed at her. Atlas follows Leon carrying a brick of narcotics. Atlas hands the brick to Chivas, who tastes the drugs. Chivas eyes Vinny and Shelby, tastes some more.
It's a real deal.
Chivas holds up a finger, and Shelby and Vinny look at each other, back at Chivas. The back door opens. The back door of the SUV opens. A bedazzled boot appears, then another. Pico, 35, shirtless and soulless, slithers out of his back seat in awful rhinestone jeans and boots. He's a patron, a boss, and his Mexican prison tats tell all of his sordid tale. Shelby and Vinny instinctively tighten up and step back as Pico eyes them. Keeping his gaze on Vinny and Shelby, Pico goes to Chivas. Pico tries the drugs, swishes them around his teeth, and he smiles.
That's good juice.
Vinny and Shelby exhale and relax their shoulders.
Do you know how I know?
Vinny and Shelby look at each other and shrug.
No.
Of course you wouldn't. No. Because it's mine.
Shelby and Vinny step backwards. Leon and Atlas aim the Uzis at Shelby and Vinny and they freeze. Pico balls up his fists and pounds his chest like an ape.
Did you sell my juice back to me? To me? Did you fucking set up Manuel and Tino, get him to load our shit into your trailer, and then you have the fucking cojones to sell my juice back to me? To me?
He pounds his chest harder and stomps up to Shelby.
You working for the Palazonte, puta?
I don't work for anyone.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Pico snarls at Shelby, eyeballs Vinny.
What about you, Peson? Who'd you working for?
You know who put us in touch with you.
Of course I do. And why do you think he did that? Think about it.
Vinny looks away, beat, her shoulders slump.
Ah, now you get it. Thought you, because you got a pussy, Mr. D's gonna give you a free pass. Chivalry, blood, country, oaths, the shit is dead. See, I don't work for no one either. No fucking WAP, no fucking Julio Sucio. I'm the king. I wear the fucking crown.
Do you know who I am?
Chivas and Leon pull burlap sacks over Shelby and Vinny's head and everything goes black.
Yes. Yes, I do. I'm talking to a corpse.
End of Act 4. Act 5. Exterior forest, Montana-Canada border night. The Escalade and Shelby's truck and trailer roll up to a makeshift camp in the forest. A couple of campers and some tents made of tarps as well as garbage, gear, and four-wheelers are scattered about. Chivas pulls Shelby and Vinny, bound and gagged, out of the back of the SUV. Leon exits Shelby's truck, helps drag Shelby and Vinny in front of the trailer, and throws in some plastic chairs. In the chairs next to Shelby and Vinny are two other men. Beaten and bloody, Shelby stares at them. Then it hits her. It's Billy and Clyde. Pico stands before the four chairs and surveys his quarry. Leon looks at Pico for orders, and Pico nods to them.
Get some juice.
Leon nods and enters the trailer. Pico pulls a handgun from his waistband and scratches his head with it. He catches Shelby looking at him, and he smiles at her. He sidles up to Shelby and whispers in her ear.
Decisions, decisions.
Leon exits the trailer holding a syringe, walks over to Pico. Pico grabs Shelby's wrist and holds her arm out. She tries to fight and kick him, but it's no use, especially when Chivas comes over and grabs her legs. Leon holds the syringe up. Shelby flinches, tries to push away, but there's nowhere to hide.
Don't knock her out. I want her awake for this.
Leon shoots Shelby. Her eyes roll back and she goes limp.
Take her inside.
Leon flops the limp Shelby over his shoulder and carries her into camper. Vinny spits the gag out of her mouth.
Hey, you fuckers better...
Atlas walks up to Vinny, and they stare at one another before he backhands her across the face. Blood drips from her nose and mouth, and she tries to lift her head up, but Atlas punches her in the head, knocking her out.
Hey, don't worry. She'll get yours.
Interior, Pico's trailer continuous. Leon drops Shelby on a seedy and dirty mattress. She collapses like a wet noodle. Shelby's eyeballs roll around in her head, and she tries to focus. Fights the restraints, but they don't budge. Leon shakes his head.
Pero estúpida.
Shelby's eyes flash around the room, searching for something. A weapon, a way out. Her eyes set upon the window next to the bed. It has a spider web of cracks, and she looks outside at the trees, swaying in the breeze. Pico enters and pulls his handgun out, hands it to Leon.
Kill them.
The girl too?
Shelby locks eyes with Pico.
See.
Pico slashes across his throat with his finger. Exterior, Pico's trailer continuous. Chivas and Leon stand before Billy, Clyde, and Vinny in the chairs. Leon hands the gun to Chivas and he cocks it. Interior Pico's trailer continuous. Shelby lies spread-eagle on the bed, her eyes glassy and dazed. Pico unzips his pants and unties Shelby's feet in restraints, climbs on top of her. Bang! A gunshot echoes from outside and Shelby flinches.
Adios, contestant number uno.
Shelby's eyes meet Pico and he sneers. He unties her wrist restraints and holds her arm down, lowers his head to her ear and whispers.
I like it when you can fight a little. Makes it more fun.
Pico reaches down and pulls off Shelby's pants, pushes them to the floor with his feet, and he lets go of one of her wrists to pull off her wife beater. Smack! Shelby elbows him in the face and flips him over so she's on top. Pico's eyes bulge. Bang! Another gunshot from outside. Shelby's head whips around the door. She looks back at Pico and he smiles.
Nowhere to run.
Shelby smiles. Pico raises an eyebrow. What's this bitch thinking? But his smile fades, and Shelby throws herself against the cracked window. Crash! Shelby flies outside and lands on her back, moaning in pain, struggling to her feet, and she flees into the forest. Exterior Pico's trailer. Pico bursts out of the trailer.
Fuck.
Chivas, Leon, and Atlas stare at him, confused.
Gun.
Chivas tosses Pico his handgun. Exterior, forest, south of the Montana-Canada border, night. Shelby leaps a downed tree, stumbles over deadfall, runs for her life, looks over her shoulder, and runs. A spotlight flashes behind her and illuminates her face.
There.
Crack. Pico fires a shot and misses. I gotta sneeze. Okay, it's gone.
Look at the light.
All right, back into it. Shelby stumble sprints through a dense evergreen forest. Shivers of moonlight cut through the darkness, illuminate her every breath, and fear clouds her eyes. Blood and mud cake her face. Her wife beater is ripped and bloody. Her white panties brown with dirt, legs cut, bruised, long strawberry blonde hair, a rat's nest of branches, leaves, and broken glass. Shelby looks over her shoulder and trips over a pointy stump. Slams into the ground, a nasty gash opening on her thigh. She stifles a cry, tears well up, she wipes them away, whips her hand around, and her eyes bug out, her breath jagged and deep. In the distance, Pico's voice calls out. A light flashes across the landscape and branches crack underfoot. Shelby struggles to her feet, chest heaving, head on a swivel, and she spots an uprooted tree with a cave of roots. She looks down from the cave at her pursuers, shadowy figures approaching. Decision time. She climbs into the cave, claws dirt, roots, and branches on top of her, and puts her hand on her chest to control her breathing. She peeks out through the web of roots and waits. 50 yards away, the shadows turn into Pico, Chivas, and Leon and Atlas. The group move in a horizontal line spread about 20 feet apart. They take their time negotiating the undergrowth and downed timbers. Pico raises a hand. The group stops, listens, snap. Continued, a twig breaks. The men peer into the dark, and Pico points right. Atlas shines the light. Nothing. Pico waves the men forward, and they inch closer to Shelby. She melts into the cave. Snap. Another twig breaks. The men stop. Pico points to the left. Atlas shines the light. Nothing. Chivas and Leon's muscles tighten. Atlas bites his lip. Shelby looks up and the moon moves behind a cloud. She squints and tries to sneak a peek at the men. She leans forward, something light-colored, maybe skin, maybe fur, flits past her. A branch cracks. Shelby clamps her hand over her mouth and pushes back into the cave. Searching the woods, Chivas drifts away from the group. Whoosh! There's sudden movement to Chivas's left. He turns, swings his gun in front of him, and his eyes narrow. Whoosh! Chivas senses something behind him. He spins around, but there's nothing there. He spins back, and the blood drains out of his face. He opens his mouth, but nothing comes out. Slash! Zing! A line of blood reaches across Chivas's throat. Brat-tat-tat-tat-tat! Chivas's machine gun fires into the trees, and blood drenches the front of Chivas's body. He drops to his knees, falls forward, and disappears in the deadfall of branches.
Chivas!
Brat-tat-tat-tat! Leon sprays the woods with his machine gun. Trees crackle, snap above Shelby's head. She flinches and covers her ears. Leon runs to where Chivas was, looking around wildly, but
Chivas,
he's gone.
Where the fuck are you?
A slick of light on the ground. Leon inches toward it.
Chivas.
The moonlight catches the slick at a new angle. It's red, a pool of blood, but nothing else there. Sweat covers Leon's brow. He spins in a circle and stares into the wood. Crouches low, hangs his gun, mumbles a prayer in Spanish.
Leon, what is it?
Leon doesn't reply. He stares blankly into the dark forest. Whoosh! Atlas swings the flashlight in Leon's direction. Atlas freezes and his pupils dilate. Leon flies, slashes carried over the ground, and slams into a tree. His neck snaps. He slides down the trunk, leaving a trail of blood. Atlas's flashlight stops on the tree and shines in the blood. Atlas's jaw drops. He's pale, sweating, the Uzi slipping out of his hand as he backs up, tripping over some deadfall.
Atlas, come here.
Atlas shakes his head. Nope.
Atlas!
Atlas stumbles to his feet, backs up faster, turns, sprints away, and crashes through the forest. His light fades away, the crashing turning into silence.
Motherfucker.
Pico tightens his grip on the gun and aims at the nothingness around him.
Come here, you fucking bitch. I'm gonna fuck you, then fuck you up.
A growl, a moan. Pico's ears perk up.
Chivas? Leon?
Pico points his gun at the darkness, creeps forward, approaches the cave. Shelby hears Pico's footsteps, looks around the cave, picks up a rock, hefts it in her hand, cocks it, ready to fight. Pico steps in front of the cave, looks down, sees a bloody stump that sliced Shelby's thigh and sneers. Crack! A twig breaks behind them. Pico turns around. Roar! Pico shrinks back, eyes wide, a shadow crosses his face, and slash! Pico's eyes glaze over. His mouth droops blood. He drools blood, his body dropping right in front of the cave, his lifeless, dilated pupils staring at Shelby. A twig snaps, and something whooshes out of the cave. Shelby shakes, drops the rock in her hand, and closes her eyes. Exterior, forest, south of the Montana-Canada border, morning. Birds chirp. A sliver of sunlight warms Shelby's face. Her eyes crack open, then pop. She reaches for the rock. Her eyes dart around. Shelby peers out of the cave, but she's alone. There's a patch of blood outside the cave, but no bodies. She looks up, and the trees sway gently in the breeze. Exterior Pico's trailer, morning later. Shelby stumbles into camp, and it's deserted except for Billy, Clyde, and Vinny strapped to their chairs. They're all bloody, their heads bent to the ground, and gunshot wounds paint their chests as Billy and, the chests of Billy and Clyde. Shelby lifts Vincent's bruised, bloody face, crust coats her eyes. She doesn't move. A tear forms in the corner of Shelby's eye. She puts her head in her hands, and Vinny groans. Shelby raises her head and smiles. She grabs a canteen sitting on the ground and lifts it to Vinny's lips, gives her a drink, and Vinny sucks down the water. Exterior, Main Street, Eureka, Montana, day. Atlas stumbles down the sidewalk. His clothes are ripped and bloody. He mumbles to himself and wags his head from side to side. The townspeople give a wide berth. After they pass him, they stop and stare. Atlas doesn't notice the odd looks he's getting shuffling past people or the police cruiser pulling up beside him. Two local cops hop out of the cruiser and grab Atlas. Atlas doesn't react. He stares ahead, mumbling in Spanish. Interior hospital, College Spell, Montana. Two female FBI agents, Hollins, 30s, curly hair, boyish leather jacket and jeans, and Moran, 30s, cute ponytail pantsuit, stand outside of the hospital room.
Gee, whoa, man. How's it hanging?
The agents ignore Cooper and eyeball Scott.
Lauren Scott.
Hollins. Moran.
Scott nods and looks in the window of the hospital room behind the agents. Inside, Atlas lies on a bed, staring into space.
We're still working on his identity, but our forensic team found where he came out of the woods, somewhere near Eureka, and they're tracing it back to where he started.
Did he give the artist anything to go on?
This is all he gave us.
Moran hands Scott a piece of paper with the drawing of one of Shelby's Mustang cowboy boots on it.
A cowboy boot. Chico's been in Montana too long.
That's it. A boot? He saw a boot.
Collins and Moran share a look.
What?
Well, he said he saw something else.
Okay.
Moran reads off her notebook.
La fantasma sin ojos.
Scott's brows furrow.
Without eyes. Something without eyes.
Ghost. Ghost with no eyes.
Ooh, scary.
Scott ignores Cooper and walks to the room window. Peers into Atlas. Feeling Scott looking at him, Atlas turns, meets Scott's gaze. Atlas, sunken, dead eyes, look right through Scott until Scott has to look away. Exterior, Montana-Canada border day. The droning of a small two-prop airplane. The aircraft banks across the blue skies. The plane drops in altitude, and below it are pristine forests, lakes, and mountains. Not a house or person in sight. The plane banks again, a dirt landing strip appearing below the forest. The plane lands, pulls up to a stop, and a small staircase folds down from the floor. From the door. It opens, letting out four narco commanders, 30s, dressed in matching black fatigues and carrying AK-47s. They fan out along the runway. Mako Cruz, 40s, tall, fit, with chiseled good looks of a daytime soap star, follows down the stairs. He wears a pristine black suit, crisp black collared shirt, and a white crocodile skin cowboy boots. He surveys the unspoiled wilderness before him, raises his arms till he's in a Jesus Christ pose, and takes a long, deep breath of the fresh mountain air. Exhales. Exterior, National Forest, Montana, night. A bonfire rages in front of Shelby and Vinny. Both wear bras and panties. Shelby's truck and trailer idles behind them, and they watch their clothes burn in the fire. Vinny lifts a pair of heels covered in blood, looks away in disgust, and flings them into the fire.
Goodbye, Gucci.
Shelby slides off her boots, hefts them in her hands, and lovingly traces the Mustang design with her fingers. One by one, she flips the boots into the fire, and the flames lap around them, enhancing their beauty. They catch and burn up, disappearing in the flames.
We gotta find some place to stash this stuff.
I know just the place.
off Shelby as the reds and oranges of the shadows of flames dance across her expressionless face. End of pilot. Woo. All right, guys, we're going to take a five-minute break and then have Steven calling in right after that. So we'll see you soon. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unproduced Table Read. We have Steven Camilio on the line. Steven, can you hear me?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I sure can, sir. First of all, thank you so much for being here, and thank you for letting us read this very exciting pilot on air.
Oh, I appreciate it. You guys did a great job. Thank you.
Thank you. And I did hear you. Quickly, I want to qualify. I thought this was a finalist for the ATX Festival. It's currently a semifinalist, but here's to crossing our fingers that it will be a finalist for the ATX Festival. So... and I also want to apologize for mispronouncing your name when we first went live. I was laughing with my panel. I feel like I'm always booking these very talented Italians for our call-ins, and I'm always notoriously mispronouncing their names. Whenever I bring someone in studio, it's like, this is Ann Smith, and then whenever I bring someone in on the phone, I like always mispronounce their last name. But Steven, we're really excited to have you.
I'm excited to be here, and thank you. Yeah, and I realized I should have probably put a pronunciation guide in with the... in the script somewhere with all the Italians and the everyone else.
I want to talk with you about that because this is such an interesting mix of like kind of Western, almost like Ozark Mystic River feel, but then there's also this like kind of gangster classic American cinema Italian feel. You're calling me from Montana, is that correct?
Correct, but I'm an East Coast guy, yes. Born and raised. So I sort of have a foot in both worlds, you'd say.
Can you speak to that, not only in your own experience, but also how it informs your script?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think there's a lot of people out here who have come from other places. You know, I moved here from Boston by way of New York City, by way of Boston. So, you know, I have that sort of, you know, obviously I'm Italian-American heritage. So I have that sort of feel to, you know, background, but I also came out here to volunteer in Yellowstone National Park, which is, you know, one of the remotest places in the lower 48. So that's why I came out here to be a part of this landscape and this way of life that's a little more remote and a little more connected to nature. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I sort of bring both elements to it, and that, you know, that's some of the inspiration behind this script.
Are you from the North End originally?
No. My dad's from Somerville, which is
cool.
Just left of the North End. So. Yeah.
Roxy's a Bostonian.
I'm a Newton girl, so I know where you're. Yes. I know where Somerville is.
Oh, cool.
So
that's where the DiDomenicos are. That's actually my a family name, so that's how you pronounce that one.
So I'm so interested in just like the world you've drawn. Obviously, I'm assuming you don't have any personal ties to this world of narcotics in Montana, but can you talk about sort of what inspired you just to approach the topic of drug trade in Montana, especially specifically like in the Highline area that we're immersed in this script?
Yeah, you know, you hear stories. I actually was living on the southern border of Wyoming and Montana when I wrote this, and it's still, I think any sort of borderland has that feeling of mystery and sort of openness to it that sort of lends itself to storytelling. And I was writing something about that area, and it actually, someone else wrote something similar, so I sort of veered away from it. And I was hearing these stories about the drug trafficking and people trafficking and various stuff on the High Line on the northern border. And I actually interviewed a retired DEA agent just to try to find out more about it. And he sort of filtered in some of these stories about the mobsters and the Italian history of Capone and the Lucianos. All that stuff was true. That's in the story, that the Lucianos are possibly still running things out of Libby, which is right on the Canada border by Glacier National Park. So I sort of took all these truths and half truths and my love of, you know, the Untouchables and all that stuff, and sort of packaged them all together into this story. And it wasn't until I was actually watching Frozen with my two little daughters that I got the idea of the two girls that sort of tied it all together.
Yeah, it's a really bold choice, and it's an exciting one because I think so often this genre is just so inundated with male protagonists, even interesting versions of this. So, like, I do feel a bit of Breaking Bad influence, which is the reason I opened on that. But, of course, that's Walt and Jesse, and in this you chose Shelby and Vinny. Can you talk about that choice and how you feel like it might enhance your script?
Yeah, I think obviously there's that the whole, you know, idea of diversity casting that's going on in Hollywood right now. But that, I mean, that's sort of after the fact. I think there's a vulnerability that comes with the two female leads. And I think it adds an element to the script that you wouldn't get, obviously, if this were two guys, especially in Montana, where, you know, the whole ethos of the cowboy is considered this, you know, guy out on his horse all by himself. And I think when you sort of flip that on its ear, not only does it make it different, but I think it opens up a whole new avenue of storytelling. I think you close yourself off to a lot of possibilities with if it's just two guys, you know, doing guy stuff kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there's some Thelma and Louise in there?
Yeah, there's some of that. You know, like I said, I was weirdly enough inspired by Frozen. and having two daughters, that the part of that is that, I mean, they're 4 and 2, but they could not be any more different. And I wanted to sort of get that. Not only were these two women, but they're two different characters. They're not, you know, just the same, you know, female character. One of them is sort of tough and laconic and sort of, you know, in her own little world. She's never seen any of these movies and stuff. She's not worldly. She's not a city girl. And then you have this other girl who's, you know, stylish and hip and, you know, been well educated and has, you know, sort of worldly and in a respect that, you know, she knows a lot of things and she's been a lot of places. So I think when you bring those two together, that's even a more better dynamic than just having, you know, two female characters that are, you know, the same.
Mm-hmm. So how do you approach writing female characters versus sort of writing your male characters, specifically Vinny, because you're going for this sort of like stylish kind of fast, at least what I gathered, sort of this stylish, fast talking East Coast Italian chick kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, like, what were your references for that? Like, how do you go about approaching that character when you're actually in the headspace of writing?
You know, I borrow a lot from, you know, people I've known. I worked at InStyle magazine for a lot of years in New York City. And not only did it sort of get me in tune with my feminine side, you know, doing a lot of fashion and beauty and stuff like that, but I also worked with a lot of strong women, and I always have. I worked in a lot of magazines in New York, and there were a lot of the editors were women and editors in chief. And I took a lot from that. You know, I take a lot from my family, people I've known, and I think that, and even like I said, my 4 and 2 year old, they have such strong personalities that I try to just build off of that, and then sort of make them attuned to where they are or make them not attuned to where they are, sort of either they're a part of the landscape or they're sort of a fish out of the water, and that sort of navigates me to the choices they make.
Mm-hmm. The script is so inherently cinematic. I mean, like, I think Montana is such a you do a good job of describing these vast open landscapes. And is that a space you enjoy writing? I mean, so much television is set in cities. Do you feel like living in Montana is like a naturally cinematic place to live and kind of get inspired by?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm inspired by the landscape, and one of my favorite things about writing is sort of capturing a place. I have a background in studying Irish literature and Irish poetry, and they talk about the poetry of place in some of these Irish poets and how they'll use place names or the language of the landscape. Mm. And that thoroughly inspired me. And one of the reasons I moved to Montana is because of the book A River Runs Through It it captures the place in such amazing way in a narrative and then the writing that I try to capture that in all my writing. I love to throw in place, real places and the people that sort of inhabit them. And I think it really grounds the writing and really influences the story.
Can you talk a little bit about why you had Shelby be a kind of a weak protagonist in the sense of her being basically broken and battered throughout the whole script due to her addiction or withdrawals, I should say? So is there a reason why you decided to give her these withdrawal symptoms but kind of never really address it?
Yeah, well, I think, all that with a pilot, I try to put the seeds in there but not answer every question. So I wanted her to be, two-sided. Like, she has this physical strength and determination that's sort of offset by these weaknesses she has that she sort of can't get out of the way of, be it her physical pain or the drugs. So I thought that the two of them were sort of fighting each other. And I thought that would, that would be something that would carry on through this, at least through this first season, of the battle of her strengths and her weaknesses.
Yeah, because it's nice that you introduce her as this kind of badass rodeo chick, but then that side of her is really non-existent throughout the entire script other than that one moment when she escapes through the window. So I just thought that was cool. It's like it's a setup and knockdown, but not what the audience is expecting.
Yeah, and I wanted her to be strong enough that you believe that she could get away from this guy, but her weaknesses are what sort of put her there.
Mm-hmm. Is there a potential love story between Shelby and Vinny at any point that you maybe envisioned?
I never envisioned that. And I didn't, and actually someone had asked me before sort of where is the love story here. And I never envisioned one. I everyone seemed to be in such disarray that nobody was sort of set up for a love story or a relationship. I mean, I think that their relationship is the heart of the pilot and the series or would be series, but whether that would be romantic or not, it was nothing that it never occurred to me. And it could happen, but it wasn't something that I embedded or was trying to, seed here.
Yeah, no, I wasn't saying that it needed a love story. I was just saying they're two women in a very male dominated field. So I just thought that just to add an extra FU to that, they would just be like, yeah, you know what, screw it. And just obviously Shelby just gives off this air of just like, I'll screw anybody and anything.
I get that.
To get what I want. You know what I mean? That's just how I read it.
Huh.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's interesting how other people sort of see that, and I love how people get their own feeling from it and their own, look to the future of it, have their own sort of ideas. Oh, you could do this or you could do that. I think it's amazing when you talk to people about it that, something you wrote, people put their own stamp on it.
So I got to ask, this script takes a pretty hard left turn once they get out in the jungle. With the eyeless ghost, what inspired that turn for you, and why? Because I mean, reading it as an audience member, you're like, all right, holy shit, what's gonna happen next? But you're also just like, what just happened?
Yeah, are we in the supernatural or no?
Well, that's sort of something I've left hanging for whoever wants to buy this. But There are stories. I mean, this is another thing that's loosely based. There are stories of people saying that there's something that haunts the borderlands up there, and that they're these guys that come over, the narcos or the drug traffickers have said that there's a spirit up there that haunts it and kills people or stuff like that. So there is a sort of an idea behind it, and I have an idea, or I know what it is, but I wanted that mystery in it. And I was loosely inspired by watching Stranger Things of that sort of mystery. And I wanted an element of that in the script, Whether or not it's supernatural or not, that's something you have to tune in to find out.
Here's my question. So at the end of the script, Vinny asks Shelby, you know, we have to find somewhere to stash this stuff. And then Shelby goes, I know just the place. Now, is she referencing the cave that she just got out of? Because I can't imagine that they would go back to that cave after seeing what she saw. And if there is a supernatural presence there. Right?
No, she's not referencing that. Okay. Actually, there was. It's interesting to have it read. Because there have been some scenes that I were in and were taken out, and then were in and were taken out, and they're mostly some flashbacks that deal with Lorne, how he sort of got to Montana, and then with Shelby and her dad, which would be sort of a storyline through the first season. Mm-hmm. We touch on it a little bit when she's with the rancher. Mm-hmm. And she goes to look at her old house. So the spot she's talking about actually is, you know, this isn't a secret or a mystery. It's the barn behind her old house.
Okay.
Which is where her father used to do things that she doesn't know about or was sort of secretive own stuff. So. Hmm.
I feel like, Stephen, a lot of kind of Americana movies or TV shows that are set in remote parts of the U.S. run the risk of presenting their characters as kind of like these boony, hillbilly, like, you know, just maybe not flattering or even complicated portrayals of this part of America. Do you feel a responsibility to sort of push back against that with this pilot? And if so, how do you, like, kind of approach that?
You know, I think some of that is true, and I think some of that comes across in Plumber. But I think that there's a diversity of, you know, people and culture and sort of just, you know, lifestyles that people don't know about. You take the Jeff character who owns a skate shop in Big Sandy. His name is loosely taken from Jeff Ament, the bassist from Pearl Jam, who is from Big Sandy, Montana. And he really works to promote sort of arts and culture in Montana that a lot of people doesn't know is here, sort of, you know, alternative lifestyle, I guess you'd say. Mm-hmm. There's the professor who, you know, there's this rich history here in Montana when I tried to get that across. But then you do have people like Plummer who are sort of, you know, blue collar, sort of, I wouldn't say racist would be the word, but sort of closed minded people. So I try to get a mix of it. So, yeah, I think I'm trying to give you every bit of Montana there is, not just the good old boy side or the, you know, the mountain man side.
Cool. Well, Andrew.
Yeah, I guess it's my time. So is this the first time you've ever had a table read? And if so, is there, you know, what did you learn? What do you want to change? What worked? What didn't work?
Yeah, it's the first table read, so thank you. I appreciate it. You know, there's a couple times where I went for humor that I don't think came across as funny, and some of them did, I think. So you sort of get an ear for, you know, where you guys sort of got the joke and where you didn't. I think anytime you hear the dialogue, you hear a couple things that you don't need that it's already been explained somewhere else. So I sort of checked a couple boxes there. But I'd love to know what you guys thought reading of it. If there's, you know, a couple places where things worked or didn't work or things need to be explained.
You know, I think just for me, like, it does feel like Vinny and Shelby is the central kind of anchor of the script in the world. And I feel like we could use a little more of just their interplay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's just my, mm-hmm. I mean, that's maybe just one, even just one additional scene. It's in great shape. I don't want to imply that any changes need to happen, but that would be my takeaway, is just a little more of Shelby and Vinny, not only as partners, but as people, I think.
I think it'd be nicer to meet Vinny sooner, mm-hmm. Only because she ends up being such an important part of, and really being that partnership is what is kind of like the foundation of the show. So to have that introduction come a little bit sooner, I think would be nice.
Mm-hmm. She feels like the Walt and Shelby feels like the Jesse, which is cool.
It's interesting. I like that a lot. Yeah.
That's great. I appreciate that. And I you know, they get the breaking, people always sort of mention the Breaking Bad thing. And I was living in Yellowstone for most of the time that Breaking Bad was on and didn't have a TV. So I sadly have to say that I don't get most of the Breaking Bad references.
It's a good show.
Yeah. It's good. It'll keep this original.
It's on Netflix.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Yeah, you won't fall into the traps of stealing from it if you don't watch it. But it also is great. And I think it might be worth at least that first season.
Yeah. It's a short season, too.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, we so appreciate it. And again, thanks for letting us bring this on air. For folks who want to buy this thing, what's the best way to reach you?
I got a website, StephenCamilio.com. I'm working with a cool producer named Kelly McKendry. She's out in L.A. So we're, you know, trying to get as many people to read as possible. So you can find us, you know, on my website, or it's on the blacklist, where we've gotten some great feedback, and that helped it get onto the ATX, writer selection.
Great.
So we're on there as well.
Perfect. Well, Stephen, we can't thank you enough, and let's be in touch.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
All right, you got it. All right.
Bye, thank you.
Bye. Well, guys, this has been the Unproduced Table Read. Today we read The High Line by Stephen Camilio. Cleverly, that's spelled H-I-G-H-L-I-N-E because of the narcotics twist. So that's, again, The High Line by Stephen Camilio. You can reach him on his website or on the blacklist. For those who like today's scripts, we read a script last year called The Hunter and the Mystic that also sort of deals with the culture of narcotics in remote spaces. So I would check that one out. And this is the Unproduced Table Read, guys. We're here every week, either at 9 a.m. or 10 a.m., depending on if we're reading a pilot or a feature. Next week, we do have a feature. It's another, actually, female-driven crime comedy, though. It's a little lighter. It's called Cuttlefish, and it's very strange but very wonderful, and I can't wait to have it read. In the meantime, guys, my name is Jeff. If you want to find me online, you can do that on Twitter at Jeffrey C. Graham. For fans, we've been getting more and more reviews on our iTunes page, which has been great, some good feedback. But keep bringing that. It really, really helps our show if you guys hop on iTunes and give us that 5-star rating, because obviously what else would you do besides 5 stars? But we appreciate the feedback, and we appreciate you guys reaching out, so please continue to do that. How about the rest of you guys?
I'm Haley O'Connor online as Haley O'Connor.
Thanks for tuning in, guys. I'm Timothy Michael. Find me everywhere at I Am Timothy Mike.
I'm Adrian Snow. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Miss Adrian Snow. You can also catch me on Wednesdays for The Magicians on AfterBuzz.
Hi, I'm Andrew Guy. You can find me at Andrew Guy. Bye.
Roxy Stryer. You can find me at Roxy Stryer.
All right, guys, thanks for being here. We'll see you next week at 9 a.m. here on the Unproduced Table Read.
Bye, guys.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.